Nó không giống như nó là vì mẹ ta là nàng. If one were to study this thing, one would be tempted to find the same mechanics of being in the first book of the Odyssey. From her fragrant high-roofed chamber came forth Helen, and the handmaid Philo brought a silver basket filled with finely spun yarn, and the carpet was laid the dispatch laden with violet dark wool. So Helen sat down upon the floor, and below are the footstool for a seat. The central action of this poem, the dramatist persona, and the gift of immortality, with the promise of fulfillment, are identical in Homer and in Hawthorne. It is extraordinary, if one admits these parallels, that two of Hawthorne's greatest sonnets could have been inspired by Homer. We may safely infer that the Hellenic anthology of epic verse that could be selected from the four books of the Pantheon would be a mere adumbration of the one that might be composed from the remaining thousands of pages of Hawthorne's poetry. Such an anthology would be remarkable for its diversity of subjects, its poetic richness, its humility, and its civilizing power. It would be supported and illuminated by poetic theory, rather chaotic in organization, too rapidly formulated, but representing in vigorous and eloquent language a point of view that in its Hellenic orientation transcends French writing. The literature of France is still living within the momentum of this transformation. From the attunement of his ear and mind to the brazen instruments of the epic, Ronsard introduced into the poetry of his country tonalities that were a radical acoustic innovation. The sounds of the Euphratic Catalanity in the ode to Michel de L'Hôpital must have fallen with shattering effect upon the unaccustomed senses of his readers, simultaneously dazzled by the vision of a world flaming and reeling beneath the lightning bolts of youth. Through the gates of Homer and Hesiod, Ronsard stepped far into a natural world which the blind poet sought him to see both in human terms and as aspects of the divine. The imagery of Homer enlarged his comprehension and his sympathy, revealed the affinities between the realms of nature and poetry, until he was able to see the destiny of a man written in a stricken flower, or the destiny of humanity in the falling leaf. He peopled strength first with the names and histories and ethical ideas of the great epic heroes and heroines. He made strength acquainted in a way that Homeric scholars could achieve only in a limited fashion with the religion of youth and of the epic period, with their terrible divinities of earth and lust and blood and vengeance, and their gracious and kindly divinities of forest and field and stream, and with the College of the Muses. From the pages of Homer, aided by his reading of the Old and New Testament, he forged the personal and liberating concept of a mighty universal and beneficent deity. When he laid down his pen, Ronsard had earned the Homeric title of a teacher of France.
Which assisted William Harvey to prove that the blood moves in the circuit in the body,
have been taken as the authors of a bold new age of mathematical method and scientific achievement and integrity. I hope to do nothing to bring the effulgent reputations of these men, whatever I shall say here about Harvey, I hope to tie with it high approval. But I should like to make sure that his advances have been of a different sort from those commonly suggested. He did prove the circuit of the blood, and he did establish certain important findings about animal generation, but this is not my answer here. Why shall I take up questions of priority and originality? Several females, the art of Columbus and Sir Vitus, evidently came within sighting distance of very important discoveries concerning the blood and vascular system. That is not particularly pertinent here, for although Harvey was a conscious student of his predecessors in anatomy, still as he Galileo, there was a synthesis in his work of value far beyond the sum of its parts or antecedents. What I find more interesting in itself and consequential for understanding science in the Renaissance and after is that Harvey's great demonstration is the result of a thorough application of certain principles, logical and metaphysical, that are by way of being forgotten by the anatomists, including the Aristotelians in Renaissance Italy. Paradoxically, these principles had found their completest and most subtle formulation in Aristotle himself. And though Harvey frequently says that Aristotle's physiology is wrong, nevertheless, I can expect to say that the reason why the Englishman succeeded so brilliantly was that he represented preeminently the steady discipline of the Aristotelian analytic, metaphysics, and attendant treatises. Harvey's debts to Galen and to many of the Renaissance and matters of instruction were no doubt greater, yet the pleasure he took from Aristotle's methodology was incomparably more important to his inquiry and demonstration. Harvey's discovery of the circulating of the blood came as a climax to the revival of Greek learning which got underway in Italy in the 14th century and in England in the 15th. It was most of all the anatomical emphasis in Galen which, after being developed by Vesalius, Columbus, and Fabricius, led to the framing of Harvey's question. Had the strongest influence in biology been from the Hippocratic school, or from Aristotle or the Arab doctors, discovery of the true movement of the blood might have been postponed another 50 years when the compound microscope would make easier the inspection of capillaries. Such inspection would virtually force men to see their circulation without demanding the rigorous proof that Harvey gave, lacking as he did means to observe the transmission of blood from the arterial branches through the extremities and organs to the venous branches. He employed methods of reasoning to find systematic connections between the concepts he used, and he made good by a theoretic extrapolation the deficiencies of the mechanical means at his disposal for looking into the body and tracing the traces of small parts below the limits of ocular evidence. From his casual references, one may easily feel that his attitude toward Aristotle is at best ambivalent, and it must be some of the more early remarks that commentators have taken their cue, showing that he sought Aristotle's overthrow. I profess he begins both to learn how to teach anatomy, not from books but from deceptions, not from the positions of philosophers but from the fabric of nature. Again, he called certain ideas of Aristotle running from hasty conclusions, like patterns of darkness, he goes on, may suddenly vanish before the light of anatomical inquiry. This is hardly the respectful treatment of a master by a devoted disciple. Yet Harvey also says, the authority of Aristotle has always such weight with me that I never think of differing from him inconsiderately. Much more significantly, Harvey's preface to his own treatise on animal generation is largely a parallel with the sections of the posterior analytics and the physics of Aristotle. In addition, one finds the motion of the heart battered with so familiar parapathetic notions such as nature makes nothing in vain, the heart is the center of life, and so forth. The appeal to self-deception is finally found in moreover, as man assured and manifest in matters ensured by reason is quite impossible, as the Aristotelian theory of science, or even mathematics, is said to be revived by an intellectual process of abstraction of quantities, originally perceptible as the accident of bodies. Their induction proceeds from singulars grasped first by the senses, and their absence of one kind of sense, vision, for example, is bound to result in corresponding deficiencies in scientific knowledge. Now he offers a variety of Aristotelian pronouncements in his own remarks on the growth of knowledge. Although, he says, there is but one road to science, that to it in which we proceed from things more known to things less known, from matters more manifest to matters more obscure, and universal but principally known to us, now explained by reasonings from universals particularly, still, the comprehension of universals by the understanding is based on the perception of individual things for the senses. For Aristotle, some person cannot judge the substance before he before, but is limited to judging what a particular thing is impressed upon the sense organ. This limited kind of knowledge, if it be knowledge at all, is not real science. Demonstration develops from universals, sensation is of the particular. Since it is impossible to familiarize the future even with mathematics, by deductive syllogism alone or by solely grasping the universal, we must entire induction to lead up to the universal. Our mental processes start from individuals in order to give content to the subject of science. The content must begin with the essence of what is demonstrated. The statement of this essence is a definition which is intuitively grasped but is prepared for by induction. The motion of our hat has three kinesthetic senses. All in all, the two falls into five distinct parts. The first, the introductory matter, in which Harvey, after setting forth his purposes, shows the difficulties and inconsistencies in the views of his predecessors. Second, a short statement of the reasons for composing the text. Third, on the exact motions of the hands and arteries. The fourth and perhaps most crucial and revolutionary, dealing with the motions of the blood, both in the lesser or pulmonary circulation and in the greater or systemic, and adding a summary. Finally, a series of atmospheric arguments concerning the principal ones about the circuit of the blood. Thus, the movement of Harvey's thought is not a simple Spencerian one, from inductions to deductions, or Euclidean, from axioms to theorems. Now, is it quite the kind of concept such as scientific method made popular in our modern textbooks, the gathering of facts, the formulating of theories, the deducing of conclusions from the latter, and finally the confirming of the conclusions? Rather, Harvey employs a composite method, in which he is constantly measuring authorities against his own observations, dialectically weighing each with the other, though in quite different ways, and at the same time laying down principles by which to demonstrate the natural motions and purposes of the arteries, heart, and blood. That's a series of technical procedures, dissecting, bloodletting, ligating, and so forth, and the results are never baldly reported, but are always presented in the light of a problem generated either by the conflict between observed facts and received professional opinions, or between opinions and the necessary principles of physics. Our principles inductively prepared for and intuitively grasped in Harvey's own anatomical and physiological science. I should like to consider three interlocking instances of Harvey's method. Three, from his observation of almost inexhaustible, continuous complexity. The first example concerns the contents of the blood vessels. Harvey suggests that since the movements and structure of the heart differ from those of the lungs, and those of the arteries differ from those of the chest, different functions or purposes are lacking. This is what Aristotle would call a sign, reasoning continues back to cause and some cause. It is a proof, furthermore, that something is or may be connected with something else. Aristotle is careful to point out that in many cases this kind of syllogism is as valuable as one beginning from causes. Harvey now brings eight objections against Galen's abstract view, noting that what Galen says is self-contradictory, contrary to experience, contrary to reason, and contrary to experience. objection 6 in the list then, the translation is clearly better, as Galen says, we may ask how the emperor can carry the vital spirit and the blood from the heart to the extremities. From the blood, for the blood runs the extremities. How shall David ask the conqueror, for it would appear that the emperors themselves shall heat in some way, and not cool air? So how do we conclude that the blood alone is to be found in emperors, as indeed is implicit in Galen's own experiment? The second example has to do with the so-called greater circulation, that is, the passage of blood from the left ventricle through the arteries to the body as a whole, and its final return by way of the veins to the heart again. Here, having made use of the same series of arguments, some of them avowedly suffocative regarding quantities of fluid. Blood is fresh, he says, by each beat of the heart into the left ventricle, and in 30 minutes, the total amount of blood cells required would be far greater than that which could be furnished by a metamorphosis of consumed food into blood. This takes for granted a physical principle that a certain amount of material is not made from that lesser, quicker amount. Aristotle had taught that blood reaching the peripheral ends of the vessels from the heart was converted into hair, eyelashes, and so forth, while whatever did not reach the cutaneous layers was deposited as internal stuff. Harvey does not even bother with this, since his measure would show blood that moves in large quantities in organisms having little or no new tissue. An opponent objecting that though the heart may be and the chest may be shut, nevertheless no blood need be prepared, the heart merely contracting about some spiritual substance, is answered by Harvey's remark that he has already proven that spirit separated from the blood itself and not moved when the heart is moved, not moved when the blood is moved, would not be spirit at all. But the heart supplies a mere nothing by its contractions is against reason. In passing, Harvey notes that his quantitative results, he calculates about 500 ounces of blood for 30 minutes in humans, would vary with temperament, age, and so forth. But in nearly any case, all the blood in the body can be drained away in about half an hour. All Harvey is really saying is that Harvey's figure may not be accurate, at least the blood flow cannot go below a certain minimum, which in turn is considerably above a certain other figure, the maximum that blood would have to be converted from the intake of food. This is not at all against Aristotle's view of mathematics, which allows that geometric and arithmetic reasoning is hypothetically necessary. What both Aristotle and Harvey would object to is the insistence that because mathematical formulas can fit in certain cases, they are somehow positive of the effect in an essential way. Number is a causal, number determinant, and the mathematical method can only prove certain traits of one kind of thing, but not the two things are essentially alike. As we prefer, applied mathematics does not give you the set of derived equations and proportions from results, but only from general statements that certain connections hold between quantities of things. We cannot discuss here the symmetry and diameter of vessels leaving the ventricles, the position of valves in the heart and veins, and so forth. All the chief arguments in the third portion of the motion of the heart are in terms of state, size, and movement, not of purposes of such chemical functions as the contracting of blood or spirit. But it is part of Harvey's achievement to be able to make sure these two and skillfully to merge the new results to those mechanical ones just as standard. From our third example, every kind of the two others relates to the general notion of purposes of heart and blood. Harvey is dealing with a living body. Nutrition, sensation, motion, and other capacities are instinct in it, along with the heart which regularly inspires the blood, as it were, in the surface. In fact, Harvey following Aristotle was considered the final causes of the heart, the vessels, and the blood, as well as their material causes and the efficient causes of their structure and motion. The last three chapters of the motion of the heart show the several parts in their teleological relations to each other and to their body as an organic whole. The efficient and material cause by themselves would give us a mere hydraulic system, inconsequentially related to the living body. These two chapters, again, are labeled a posteriori, that is, the beginning is manifest and can be to the causes. Having their teleologies, since the purposes of supporting evidence after the high injuries and zones have all been mechanically interpreted in relation to each other and to the motions of the blood they contain. In the same way, Einstein would distinguish between what he called biological necessity and biological reason, the latter working for a definite end with finite means. Both, he thought, were necessary, though in varying proportions to explain them. Some have wondered why Harvey never calls the heart a pump, and of how this is what he must really have known. I submit, on the other hand, that he became fully aware of the methodological implications of Einstein's metaphysical causes, feeling the need of an account fully commensurate with the nature of the facts and motions described. He was hardly so naive as to think of the heart always as a mere efficient cause, though it is always an entire of blood. He was more subtle than to assert that the heat is always the final cause of both part and whole in the body. He would have considered the description of systole and diastole as always respectively active and passive, to stand in need of reservation. But these involutions in his dialectic are not as historians are sometimes thought, the result of history compilation, last notes, or alike. Isocelian causes are ascribed to specific parts of the body with respect to certain other specific parts or functions. They are not laid down dogmatically for an entire subject matter. But however the animal digests food, makes blood in the digestive tract, and then the heart perfects and apportions it to the rest of the body. The blood is part of the body, nourishes and is nourished, and is both a physical cause and material cause with respect to these nutritive functions, but not to the motor functions. Harvey says that the heart replenishes heat lost in the blood to the extremities. For him, the inner heat is the prime cause and instrument of every function in the living creature. He says, the blood, instead of receiving, rather gives heat to the heart as it does to all other parts of the body, for the blood is the hottest element in the body. For this reason is the heart remarkable to its cavities to be viewed as the laboratory fountain and perennial surface of heat, and is comparable to a hot kettle, not because of its proper substance, but because of its contained blood. So blood is the material cause of the heat of the body. The blood is that which is called the heart of the heart, is the final cause of the heat, not the heating agent, but the structural condition of heating. The heart gives movement to the blood, hence is the efficient cause, not of the blood itself, or of heat, but of its motion. Here, then, are three abbreviated examples of Harvey's complex method, using Einstein's logical proof and his first philosophy of interrelated causes. From then, it is seen that we should not interpret Harvey as a repeater of the structural concepts of Einstein's system, merely elaborating upon them and then putting some alleged observations into them. If, on the other hand, we think of Harvey as making use of the concept in heuristic fashion, and then finding them reasonably fruitful in his preliminary dialectical examination of possibilities and authorities, making some of these possibilities principles for demonstrating the circuit of the blood, then this methodological reading of Harvey's relation to Aristotle makes sense. This kind of use would explain Harvey's singular combination of blood and rhythm. From Aristotle's theory of induction and the intuitive grasp of first principles, Harvey realized that even if the final conditions of syllogism are adhered to, but the inquiry is not restricted to classes of facts one at a time, which by their instruction can give quick reference to the terms chosen, then the result would be loose terminology indecisive truth. We prove conclusions for one subject matter as such. We would not prove conclusions about facts and premises about facts, or conclusions about blood and premises about divine spirit, however much a heart in some way may accidentally resemble a fact or blood spirit. Connecting outside a unique subject matter is coincidental, not necessary. In the main, Harvey has adhered admirably to a method meeting the requirements of an Aristotelian frame. This in itself does not make him a great man. But it may be that he grasps not only the importance of the concept of chemistry and motion, as he fell into wrong abuse, but also rank as forever and so on, a longer list of fundamental categories. With so many technical obstacles in front of him, he is able, using some very sophisticated means of reasoning, together with a large variety of manual procedures, to devise this particular demonstration. And the demonstration has, in its large outline, and nearly all its details, give or take one or two parameters in the section, being understood and accepted even by those lacking close acquaintance with the theoretical presuppositions upon which Ivy rested. I've endeavored to show that originality and soundness of the view are not wholly incompatible with the use of concepts and methods derived from a tradition long held in disrepute for its clarity and stodginess. The later history of medicine, however much it embraced Ivy's anatomical findings, could have done worse than to continue to learn more from the happy employment that he made of the profound methodological contribution of our science.